Okay, good morning, everybody. And again, I thank the monastics and the whole team of the Zen Mountain Monastery for inviting me to conduct the program this weekend and also to give the talk this Sunday morning. I'm just sorry that Shugen Roshi was not here this weekend, but I understand he had to conduct some program already predetermined in Buffalo. Yeah, sometimes people ask me, like, how did you as a scholarly monk become a Buddhist activist? And by temperament, I have to say, I'm not really an activist. My greatest joy was during my time in Sri Lanka, where I could devote myself to the study of the Buddha scriptures, translation of the scriptures, practice of quiet meditation. But particularly after I came back to the United States, I returned in 2002, and for the first time, I had access to the internet, apart from emails. In Sri Lanka, I had access to email, but not to the rest of the internet. And I began to see what is going on in the world, and what I saw deeply disturbed me and aroused, I would call, a very deep sense of conscience. I had the feeling that as a Buddhist who's committed to the principles of, or the values, the ideals of loving kindness and compassion, it's not sufficient just to nurture those qualities as inward, subjective, meditative states, but it's necessary to be able to translate them into courses of action that will uplift those who are afflicted with the most degrading, humiliating, oppressive types of suffering. And so I came to coin in my mind an expression that I called conscientious compassion. This is compassion that is conjoined with a sense of conscience. And by conscience here, I mean not a feeling of guilt, but rather conscience in a more positive sense of taking one's deepest and most heartfelt moral ideals, taking them from the sphere, the ideal sphere of aspiration, intention, wish, and then seeking to embody them in one's actions, one's involvement in the world by taking on a sense of responsibility, feeling that you yourself, I myself, am responsible for the course of events that take place in this world. Particularly as I was sort of reading the news reports and sort of reflecting on them, digesting what I was coming to understand, I came to see at least four major problems that we're facing, really critical problems that we're facing in the world today. First, one of them is the persistence of wars, the spread of wars, and particularly in our case, the involvement of the United States in these wars. I was in Singapore in 2001 when the World Trade Center was demolished. And then when I heard about the United States planning to launch an attack on Afghanistan, I felt that even though the Taliban government in Afghanistan was a despicable government, but the appropriate response to the actions of Al-Qaeda was not for the U.S. to launch a war against Afghanistan, a war that now is still continuing. What is it, 17 years now? And then after I came back to the U.S., the United States launched its attack on Iraq, and now the U.S. is involved to some extent in wars going on in many countries. So this is encouraging the persistence of a militarism and militaristic policies, which are managed by a kind of deep state constellation that underlies any government that comes into power. Any government that comes into power has to comply with the directives that are coming from this deep state, which joins together, I guess, the intelligence agencies, the military, the Pentagon, the CIA, and a whole host of arms manufacturing corporations. So this is one great problem, the problem of persistent militarism, which just is swallowing up so much of the national budget. I believe that more than half of the discretionary budget in the United States goes for military purposes. That's something like $700 billion just being swallowed up in military activities, money that could have been used to benefit ordinary citizens, to improve our infrastructure, our educational system, to provide aid to the poor, to promote welfare programs, even single-payer healthcare system. All of that is being just decimated in order to maintain our military activities. A second problem that we're facing, major problem, and I had some statistics, and that is poverty and income inequality. Well, I didn't get... I think a page was missed where I had statistics. But anyway, I have the statistics on poverty in the United States. So according using what's called the supplemental poverty measure, some 43.5% of the U.S. population, that's 140 million people, are poor or low income. And that includes some 34% of whites, 60% of blacks, 65% of Latinos, and 40% of Asians. 32 million people are without any form of health insurance. Roughly 40% of Americans take on debt because of medical issues, making medical debt the number one cause of personal bankruptcy. Student debt has escalated $1.34 trillion. And then the current administration had proposed a 30% cut to the food stamps program, which fortunately just a few days ago that was defeated in Congress. I also had statistics on the extent of global poverty and inequality, whereby we're living in a world where something like 40 people in the United States own half the wealth of the country. 40 families own half of the American wealth. And there are similar statistics on global poverty. Okay, so global poverty. Then there's a problem in this country particularly of racism, persistent structural and systemic racism. So even though reportedly we obtained civil rights for all Americans back in the 1960s, but now even those civil rights have been undermined by the Supreme Court decision some years ago, I think it was 2013, to change the Civil Rights Act, a certain provision in the Civil Rights Act. So now states can enact measures which are suppressing the votes of especially of black and poor populations and making it much more difficult for people to vote. We have this, what they call the school to prison pipeline because of the poor conditions of schools. So inner city black kids don't get the proper education they need, the proper social provisions they need, so they take to a life of crime and then they are shepherded into the prison system and remain there through most of their lives. If they come out, they again get involved in crime and again go back. And so there are many both subtle and gross manifestations of racism in this country. And then the fourth of the great overwhelming problems that we're facing is the problem of climate change, which is, if it continues at the rate that it's going, it can demolish the very foundations of human civilization. Even if all of the countries that have made pledges, these national determinations according to the Paris Climate Accord, even if they were to fulfill their pledges without taking more severe measures, It said that by the end of this century, the global average temperature will have increased something like 3.6 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. And I had a quotation from the Journal of the British Royal Society, which says that in a world in which the temperature increases 4 degrees Celsius, the limits of human adaptation are likely to be exceeded in many parts of the world, while the limits of natural system adaptation will largely be exceeded throughout the world. And the areas of the world that are likely to be hardest hit by climate change are the poorest parts of the world. Central Africa, South and Southeast Asia, South America, those regions will be hardest hit by climate change. But since the whole world is connected together, dwells within one climate system, every part of the world is going to be severely affected. Okay, so these are some of the great crises that we're facing. And then I had some notes on how in diagnosing the underlying roots of these crises, and then to discuss what we can do about these. And I should mention that over this weekend, over the past few days, I gave a program on the Buddha's teachings on social and communal harmony. And this morning, I was going to give a talk on a pure Dharma topic. But some people asked me, they said to me, why don't you explain how we can take some of the principles that the Buddha laid down on social and communal harmony and relate them to the situation we face in the contemporary world? And so I decided to make that the theme of my talk. And I had some notes prepared from a lecture that I gave last month at MIT. And before I gave that lecture, I was a little hesitant about giving the lecture on this particular subject. So I sent my notes to the professor who had organized my lecture. And I said, do you think it's appropriate that I give a lecture like this at MIT? I said, I don't want to get you and the administration, to get you and the other faculty members who arranged this talk into trouble with the administration. And then she looked at my notes and she said, yes, please go ahead and give that talk. And don't forget, MIT is the home, the intellectual home of Noam Chomsky. Okay, so in my sort of approach to the diagnosis of these crises, I tried to point out that what I call the core malady that underlies the various social, economic, and ecological challenges that we're facing is the dominance of unregulated or weakly regulated corporate capitalism, which is bolstered by neoliberal economic theory, that is the doctrine of free market fundamentalism, which basically holds that the market provides the solution to all the problems that we're facing, and to enable the market to function freely in this supposedly most beneficent way, we have to abolish regulations, the regulations that had been laid down in earlier decades during the 1930s, 1940s. We have to allow corporations to function unfettered and unhindered. We have to reduce taxes on corporations and on the rich. We have to privatize as many public utilities as possible, because it's said, according to this theory, that when utilities are managed by the public, by government, they become bogged down with inefficiency. And so the way for them to function most efficiently is to open them to private enterprise. That private enterprise provides the solution to all of the great economic, political, and social problems that we're facing. Okay, so what is the driving force behind this dominance of unregulated capital. It's the drivers of the quest for expanding profits, for higher dividends for shareholders, for higher returns on financial investments, for increased capital accumulation. And that is also to be achieved by suppressing wages and benefits for workers. And so we have, you know, in the 1950s, 1960s, we didn't have a perfect economic system, but workers enjoyed, compared to their employers, much better standard of remuneration of wages and salaries. The gap in pay between ordinary workers and CEOs was, of course, it was fairly big, but not obnoxiously big. And workers had many benefits, which are now have been eroded. And so work has become extremely precarious for many people in the labor market. And so instead of having people getting regular, persistent, reliable jobs with adequate salaries, they often have to work at these precarious forms of contract labor. And ordinary workers work in industries in which the regulations that protected them have been systematically, gradually weakened. So especially workers who are working in industries where they're exposed to potential physical harm, illnesses because of working with chemicals, fertilizers, and pesticides, and so on, the regulations which protected them ensured a safe, fairly safe working environment. Many of those have been rolled back because they involve costs on the part of the corporations that run these industries. Okay, so how is the system maintained? I say that the system is maintained by an interlocking rings of institutions and relationships that ensure that control over the operations of the system remains in the hands of the privileged power elite, ensuring that their control is so firmly entrenched that it cannot be seriously challenged. And so within this interlocking system of institutions and relationships, I see three major rings in the system. Okay, one of these is what I call the economic ring. So this is the corporate and financial class, the corporate CEOs, financial managers, big investors, billionaires, and multimillionaires. In other words, this is what was called during the days of Occupy Wall Street, it was called the 1% and even the 1/10 of 1%. So one ring is this economic or corporate class, the corporate dominant class. Then comes, and the second ring is the political class. So this includes government officials, representatives in all three branches of government who are expected to comply with the demands of the leaders of the economic class. And so the political branch also includes what is called the deep state, which remains constant through changing administrations, and it's committed to the project of U.S. global military and political dominance to serve the interests of corporate capital. You know, when any president goes to participate in any of these gatherings of national leaders, almost always they're accompanied by CEOs of the auto industry, fossil fuel industries, pharmaceutical industry, chemical industries, because those representatives of these industries have to ensure that whatever proposals the president will accept are compliant with their own interests. Okay, so we have the economic ring, the political ring, and then there's a third ring to the system, and that is the mainstream media. And so the key to maintaining control over the system is facilitated by the mainstream media. And their role is to ensure that people, ordinary citizens, obtain, in quotation marks, information that will support the interests of the financial and corporate elite, to ensure that voices of dissent are marginalized, excluded, muffled, or if they become too prominent, ridiculed. Okay, so we have these three rings, and then in their internal relations, what I say here is that the internal relations between the components of the system are governed by the principle that ownership confers power. And so those at the helm of the economic ring, the corporate and financial elite, exercise control over the other two rings. They exercise control over the political system through, we know this too well, through campaign contributions, lobbying, pressure groups, and then, I put this in quotation marks, think tanks that define acceptable policy positions. So we have these think tanks like the Heritage Foundation, on climate, the Heartland Institute. What are some of the others? Anyway, there's a whole bunch of these think tanks that formulate policy and then provide them policy that, the ALEC, that's an extremely one, American Legislative Exchange Council. That's a kind of consortium in which all of the major corporations collaborate in order to write policy, which is then provided to the politicians. So that the bills that go through Congress are not devised by the congressional representatives themselves for the most part, but the basic lines of policy are pretty much dictated to them. Even whole bills or essential portions of the bills are written by the corporate lawyers to advance the interests of the corporations. And so the economic power elite in this way maintains control over the political system, and then over the media they maintain control sometimes through direct ownership of the media. So the major media networks, I don't watch them, so I don't really know what they are. There's Fox, NBC, CBS, ABC. ABC, I think, is the Disney Corporation. NBC is General Electric.
Comcast.
And CBS is... Anyway, there are major corporate interests behind those mainstream media stations. Okay, but now there's a particular thought, I call this the thorn in the side or the potential Achilles heel to the workings of the system. The system, on its own logic, tends towards oligarchic control, towards plutocracy, even towards autocracy. And here in the United States right now, autocracy is almost just beyond the horizon. If Robert Mueller doesn't do his job effectively, we might find ourselves faced with the real prospect of autocracy. Okay, so the system tends at least towards oligarchic control, and yet it has to operate within the legally defined contours of a system that claims to be one of democratic governance. And so the problem arises, how do those at the helm of the system avoid the challenges to their dominance that might arise from the mobilization of public opinion and concerted action to limit or undermine their power. So to do this, what they have to do is to prevent people from recognizing their shared plight, from seeing that their troubles are stemming from a dysfunctional system which is aligned against them. And then, if any action starts to arise, they must prevent that action from getting out of control and in some way undermining their program. And so they have to block the emergence of a unified movement of people who stand together in challenging the dominance of the system and to prevent them from seeking more equitable and benign alternatives. Okay, so one way to achieve this is that they have to undermine the capacity for critical reflection and serious discussions. They have to make people accept their subordinate status, which is done partly by convincing them that they are dominant. And then they have to make them feel loyal to the system that actually disregards their genuine long-term interest. And we see that occurring now. You know, it's quite remarkable. I don't want to get into the business here of political parties and political figures, but despite everything that the current administration is doing to undermine the interests of ordinary working people, low-income people, people sort of living on the margins, the very margins of Social Security, still some 38 to 40% are behind the current administration, which strikes me as just a complete puzzle, complete cause of perplexity. But why is this happening? Because those, again, who are at the control of the system are able to convince these ordinary people that the leaders are on their side, even though the leaders are continually funneling money, even through that terrible tax bill that was enacted in December, that's funneling $800 billion from ordinary people to the 1%. But people still believe that the administration is working for their interests. Okay, so some of the attitudes that, again, the controllers of the system have to try to encourage, to stimulate in ordinary people. I have them here, like extreme of individualism, so that we think that each one of us is here in a kind of hostile relationship to everybody else. We're thrown into this brute competitive system where we have to compete against others and look suspiciously on others as potentially being able to grab a larger portion of the pie. It's sort of like we have a big pie out here, maybe a big pizza pie, and the pie is cut so that 6 out of the 10 pieces are going to one person is taking 6 out of the 10 pieces, 4 pieces are left, and we have 20 people here, and you know we have 4 pieces to cut up into fifths, and yet I'm afraid that this person here to my right is going to grab my portion of the pie, and this person to the left is going to grab another portion of the pie, and I won't have anything. So there's individualism, competitiveness, consumerism, to make people think that the happiness of life is in consuming, buying, and enjoying commodities. And even though we're not earning enough to be able to buy the luxuries and the enjoyments, the commodities that we want, but we always think if I only get that lucky break, I will get enough to be able to buy those commodities. And then comes resentment against immigrants and minorities, resentment against other countries that they are trying to take benefits away from the United States, America first and above everything else. a distorted sense of patriotism, stirring up religious fervor, and so on. And so this is the way they attempt to convince those who are mired in poverty, debt, and social marginalization that their problems are due to their own private failures, to their own personal inadequacy. So each individual, if they don't succeed, they think, I am the one at fault. I'm not good enough. I have to improve myself to succeed in this competitive race against the others. And I've sometimes pondered the question, what is it that drives this mindset of domination? And why is there, on the part of the ultra-rich, this insatiable craving for wealth and power, such that, as I mentioned the other day, when a person, the heads of these major corporations, if they have income of $2 billion, they're still not satisfied with it. They want to increase it to $4 billion, $5 billion, $10 billion. You know, someone is never satisfied. So what is the reason behind that? What is the driving force? And I confess that I really don't know, but I've come up with some conjectures. And so one, I say, might be a very deep, primitive psychology of fear, a kind of fear of scarcity, which might be the residue of people living in the Stone Age, prehistoric times, when there was a constant struggle just to survive from month to month, from year to year. And so there's a deep underlying sense of lack that can never be satisfied. And then I say that this compulsion to control, to exercise mastery, is also a way of confirming the felt sense of a substantial personal identity. So this brings in like a Buddhist perspective on this angle, a Buddhist perspective on this situation, where we say that each person has a deeply ingrained sense of self, but that self, sense of self, is just referring to an illusion or a delusion. So there's no real I there, no real self there, and yet one has to perpetually try to confirm the reality of that illusory self by acquiring more and more wealth, more and more higher and higher position, more and more control over the system. And so we have a case where these drives are reinforcing each other. We have this fear of scarcity, the sense of lack, provokes greed. The greed leads to insatiable accumulation of wealth, and that wealth is acquired to exercise power, to be able to control the system to one's own advantage, or the advantage of those in one's community or social class. But then there's a fear that this power that one has acquired will be lost or captured by others who have more wealth and therefore can gain more power. And so one uses one's wealth to reinforce one's power over and over again. So this creates a vicious cycle that continues even when the price to be paid is social disintegration, rampant inequality, dangerous levels of environmental damage, and climate disruption that can potentially harm even the agents themselves. And this is something that I've wondered about, especially like with the CEOs of these fossil fuel corporations. They have to know, even though they try to spread disinformation and denial of climate change, they're intelligent people, extremely intelligent people. They have, and they rely on science to a great extent to understand the dynamics of fossil fuel extraction. So they have to know and understand that climate change is real, that it's going to have disastrous consequences. So why do they persist pursuing these policies. And I have to, the way I come to understand this is that the system is so configured that in order to hold their position, they're obliged to pursue the short-term interest of the corporations they represent, to pursue that quarterly bottom line, to show a high profit margin, returns on investment, increase in the benefits for the shareholders in order to retain their position. But when the consequences are unleashed, they're going to fall on the managers of the system themselves. And so then looking at the system from a deep angle, I call this the deep medic program or source code behind the functioning of the system, we have a metaphysic of personal atomism which endorses the ultimacy of the private self and which leads to the objectification of others and the natural world. So I am the, within myself, I have this personal, private, individual self, and so I look upon everyone else as objects, the natural world as objects, everything to be utilized to enhance, confirm, and exalt that private, individual self. Then that metaphysic of personal atomism gives rise to an ethic in the sense of a code of conduct. And that code of conduct is the idea that rational behavior means seeking to maximize one's own private interest, even at the expense of the well-being of others, even when it means the commodification of the natural world and the exploitation of other people. And then the application of this program is the quest for exponentially increasing returns on investments, a multiplying growth of money sequences at ever higher frequencies. Okay, so the consequences of this is that all domains of real value, the natural world, social systems, other people, culture, even religion and spirituality, get colonized and subjugated by this financial and economic system based on the drive for financial maximization and increasing, you know, economic control over the system. Okay, so then I developed what I call an alternative social meta program. And so here we count just like each of the main principal features of that corporate meta program. Okay, the first, in contrast to the idea of the ultimately discrete, real, atomistic self, we recognize the reality that all human beings, all living beings, in fact, everything in the universe is interconnected and interdependent. So our very being exists in essential relationship with the natural environment, with countless other people, with the entire intricate, inconceivable web of life. So our own actions, our decisions, our attitudes, even our thoughts arise through the influence of others, and everything we do, everything we think has some impact upon others. So this will entail a sense, rather than the sense of responsibility only to myself and those who are close to me, this would entail a sense of universal responsibility, so that we each recognize that we have to take responsibility for the well-being of everyone in our community, our society, in our world. Okay, then when we come to the ethical side, we come to recognize that true happiness doesn't come from maximizing one's private self-interest through detached economic calculations, but rather real happiness comes from participating in all domains of genuine value. At the human level, happiness depends on meaningful, fulfilling, uplifting human relationships, on friendships, on cooperation with others, rather than competition with others. And so in pursuing the good of all, one is also pursuing one's own good, because one's own good comes from the enhancement of the common good. From promoting and promoting the common good increases our own good. In fact, it's been found, there's a book called The Spirit Level by Richard Wilkerson and Kate Pickard, I think her name is. It's a study of the impact of inequality on society. And their study has shown that by examining statistics and number of countries around the world, they found those countries in which there's greater income inequality or wealth inequality have higher levels of crime, higher levels of mental disease, higher levels of physical disease, strokes, heart disease, diabetes, and so on, more teen pregnancies, more higher rate of abortions, greater distrust between people, more prisons and prisoners, whereas those societies that are more equal have much better figures on each of these parameters. And in amongst the countries that they studied, I think the countries that came out the highest on the happiness index were the Nordic countries, Sweden, Norway, Finland, Denmark, and I think the Netherlands was there too. And guess which country amongst the economically developed countries comes out the lowest on each of those parameters? The United States. Okay, so happiness comes from pursuing the good of all. Then the application of this program, that we recognize at first that material security is the foundation of well-being, but our lives acquire meaning to the extent that they are enriched by other types of value. So what becomes essential is showing reverence towards nature, even experiencing a sense of communion with the natural world, with the earth, and rediscovering a sense of the sacredness of the cosmos. Then when we come to the human domain, affirming human unity, pursuing equality, economic and social equality, leading to new models of governance and an equitable economy grounded in the ideal of shared prosperity and respect for the inherent limits of the larger geophysical systems in which human life is embedded. Yeah, in fact, one of the ideas, of course, we could probably never get perfect economic equality, but some of the ideas, the practical applications that would come from this would be putting a limit to the pay gap between workers and CEOs. So now it's expanded to the level in major corporations where CEOs are getting something like 400 times the income of their workforce. You know, if we reduce that, you know, we don't want to deprive CEOs who have the educational background, the expertise of a higher standard of living. But if we reduce that gap even to something like 50 times the income, it would be a more equitable economic order. And there should be certainly minimum wage should be increased. Certainly now they're saying $15 an hour, but in my opinion, maybe this wouldn't be realistic, but it should go up to $20, $25 an hour. In fact, what I've read on, if we were to project from the 1960s the minimum wage up to the present time, would be something like $22 an hour, adjusting for inflation. Okay, then I had a list of some values that should sort of guide us in our endeavor to create a society like that. So I have some of the values: solidarity, encouraging a sense of recognition of the essential unity of all people, that all people have the same aspirations to be well and happy, to thrive, to maximize their potentials, to achieve genuine well-being in many dimensions of their life. And so when we recognize that all human beings share those basic aspirations, then extending our sense of identity to them, we should feel a commitment to improve their living standards and ensure that everyone can thrive and fulfill their potential. Another value is love or loving kindness, which is manifested as a concern to promote the well-being and happiness of others. Compassion, the heartfelt urge to alleviate the suffering of others and to address the causes of their suffering. A commitment, another value is justice, a commitment to social, political, and legal justice. Another value, equity, that based on the conviction that all people should receive an adequate share of the material resources of life, then we should make an endeavor to see that they receive health care, education, a clean environment, sufficient food, clean water, and all the other material requisites that they need. Then a commitment to peace, to resolving conflicts through negotiations rather than military means. And then I have last on this list here, responsibility, being willing to act on behalf of people in need, whether near or distant, and also having a sense of responsibility for those in future generations. In fact, when I see young people, children, often I wonder what kind of world are they going to be living in after I'm gone. You know, I'm 73 now. Maybe with a little luck, I'll have another 10, 15 more years of life. But they're going, those who are like 12, 10, 12 years old now, when they're 40 years old, what kind of world are they going to be facing if we continue along the current trajectory? So I say that we should take responsibility for moving away from our growth consumerist culture driven by the need, the insatiable need to turn out ever new commodities. And instead, we should adopt an economy grounded on the principle of sufficiency, where changes, improvements are qualitative rather than quantitative, and where we have a humble and restrained, respectful attitude or recognition of the finite sustaining capacity of the earth. Okay, maybe that will be my presentation this morning. I hope I won't get kicked out of the Zen Mountain Monastery. Okay, so thank you for your attention.